40 minutes first and then open up to questions, if that's okay. The handout, I'm not going to refer to explicitly that much. It's a kind of an outline, so that if you're like me and you sometimes zone out during talks, you can get yourself caught up. If I zone out during the talk, then I might ask someone to look at the handout and tell me what I'm supposed to say next. Thanks a lot for including me. I am feeling like I should apologize or explain for something. The thing is, my wife's mother made this tie for me, so that together with its great beauty made it impossible, you know, not to wear it, though. So that's why I committed this faux pas. But so it's very natural to suppose that we can define a law of nature as a regularity that nature conforms to, or maybe an equation that the universe conforms to. But that can't be quite right, because there are almost certainly lots of mathematical regularities that the universe conforms to that aren't among the laws. And here's one easy way to see that. If a function is a solution to one system of differential equations, then there are bound to be lots of other systems of differential equations that that same function is also a solution to. So if the laws of nature provide one set of system of differential equations and the trajectory of the universe through its state space is one solution to those equations, then there are bound to be lots of other systems of differential equations that that same trajectory is also a solution to. All the equations in those other systems are also going to be mathematical regularities that the universe conforms to, but presumably we don't want to call them all laws. So you don't get to be a law of nature just by being a regularity or an equation that the universe happens to conform to. So there's more to being a law of nature than being a regularity or equation that the universe conforms to. But what is the more? What is it that sets apart the laws from all those other mathematical regularities that the universe happens to conform to? And here you want to say something like, well, the laws govern the universe. The universe is somehow compelled to follow a trajectory that conforms to the laws of nature. But for any one of those other equations that the universe happens to conform to, well, the universe just does happen to follow a trajectory that does satisfy that equation. That's all. And that seems like the right thing to say, but what does it really mean? What are we supposed to make of this talk of governing and compelling and stuff like that? That seems metaphorical. Is there a way we can cash out the metaphor? Well, here's a stab. Consider one of those other equations. Here's one right here. It's one of the equations that the universe happens to conform to, though it isn't one of the laws of nature. Well, presumably, it's kind of a big fragile accident that the universe happens to conform to this equation. And if conditions had been different in some way, like if the universe had started out in a slightly different initial state than it actually did, there's no good reason to think that it would still have followed a trajectory that satisfies this equation. Similarly, if the trajectory of the universe were one on which I slept late this morning and didn't show up for the talk, then there's no good reason to think that the universe would still have satisfied this equation, and presumably it's safe to say that it wouldn't have. By contrast, if we look at one of the equations that is a law of nature, well, if the universe had started out in a different initial state, the laws would still have been the laws. And if I had slept late and missed the talk, the laws would still have been the laws. So, so those equations would still have held. So we might put it this way. The laws of nature would still have held under a broad range of counterfactual scenarios, under which all those other regularities would not still have held. Now, of course, if the universe had taken a different trajectory, there would still have been a big set of equations that it conforms to in addition to the laws of nature. It's just that it would have been a different whole big set of other equations than the one we got in the actual world. By contrast, we don't think there would have been a whole different set of laws. A way to put this point is that the laws of nature are set apart from all those other equations that the universe happens to conform to by the fact that the laws are counterfactually robust, meaning they would still have held under a really great range of alternative ways things could have been set up. By contrast, the other equations are counterfactually fragile, meaning their satisfaction is highly sensitive to the particular details of how things actually go in the universe. And that idea has something like the status of a dogma in the philosophical literature on laws of nature. Nevertheless, I think it's probably true. And it's very common for philosophers to defend it by saying Well, by appealing to our intuitions about which counterfactuals are true. But I think that there's a better way of defending it than that. Instead of appealing to our intuitions, we can appeal to standard practices in science. And I think that there's a widespread, well-established practice, if mostly implicit, practice in physics of distinguishing between laws and other regularities that nature conforms to, and treating the laws as counterfactually robust, and not so treating the other regularities. I think that this comes out clearly, if a little implicitly, in statistical mechanics. And here's what I have in mind. So suppose you want to explain why systems out of thermal equilibrium tend to approach thermal equilibrium and then stay there once they get there. Well, using statistical mechanics, of course, you can show that that kind of behavior is typical across the space of all dynamically possible trajectories. It's not found on all the dynamically possible trajectories, but it's found on almost all of them. Now, an outsider to the practice might find it surprising that so much importance is placed on something's being typical across a whole space of possible trajectories this way. And after all, surely what scientists want to explain is what happens in the actual universe, and the actual universe only has one trajectory. So why isn't it enough just to focus on the one dynamically possible trajectory that is the actual trajectory? Why wouldn't it be enough if you could point out that the laws of nature imply that any universe that starts out in the particular initial state that the actual universe did is then going to follow a trajectory on which, you know, things tend to approach equilibrium? What extra explanatory value do you get when you add this? This is not just true of the trajectory the universe does take, but it's typical across the whole space of possible trajectories. After all, only one point in that whole space corresponds to the real world. So if we want to explain what happens in the real world, what's the point of talking about the rest of the space? And that's the question that I'm imagining an outsider to the practice asking. And it seems to me that the answer to that outsider's question is something like this, that when we want to explain why things out of equilibrium tend to approach equilibrium, what we want is an explanation that shows that that's not just kind of a big fluke. And to show that that's not just a big fluke is to show that it wasn't highly sensitive to the particular details of how things were set up. But that's just to say that when we want an explanation of why things tend to approach equilibrium, we want an explanation that shows that that behavior is counterfactually robust, that it would still have happened, even if conditions had been different in any of a vast range of possible ways. So that's what we want. Is that what we get from statistical mechanics? Well, from statistical mechanics, we get nice arguments that that behavior is typical across the space of all dynamically possible trajectories. But what are the dynamically possible trajectories? Well, they're the logically possible trajectories that conform to the laws of nature. So what we want is an argument that shows that things would still have proceeded in the tending toward equilibrium kind of way, even if conditions had been very different in a vast range of ways. And what we get is a demonstration that they would still have behaved in that way in almost any way they could have been set up, so long as the universe still conforms to the laws of nature. We don't get any information about what things would have been like in those logically possible trajectories that don't conform to the laws of nature. So what we get from statistical mechanics is what we wanted, only if the universe would still have followed a trajectory that conforms to the laws of nature, even if conditions had been a little different. So this sort of standard explanatory strategy in statistical mechanics delivers what we want it to, only if the laws of nature are counterfactually robust. They would still have held, even if conditions had been different in some way. And that's the reason why it seems to me that this idea, the idea that what's special about laws, or anyway, one of the things that's special about laws is their counterfactual robustness, is not just a philosopher's intuition, but it's also built right into scientific practice, or at least it's built right into statistical mechanics. Now, once you notice this fact about the laws of nature, it seems to me that it transforms a whole bunch of other important questions about laws of nature, including, I think, some of the ones on the list. So take the question of how it's possible for us to discover laws of nature. Well, that's not just the problem of how it's possible for us to discover which equations the universe conforms to. It's also the problem of how it's possible for us to discover which equations are the counterfactually robust ones. And take the problem of why does our universe have the laws of nature it does rather than some other set of laws of nature? Well, that's not just the problem of why our universe obeys the equations it does rather than some others. It's also the problem of why certain equations rather than others are the counterfactually robust ones. And then take the basic philosophical question of what is a law of nature? What is it to be a law of nature? Well, it seems that any acceptable answer to that question is going to have to help explain why it is that the laws are so counterfactually robust. And in fact, a lot of us philosophers who work on laws of nature take that to be the central problem, to come up with an account of laws, of what laws are that can explain why they are so counterfactually robust. And a lot of philosophers have put forward metaphysical theories of the nature of laws of nature that they claim can explain why laws are so counterfactually robust. And some of these theories are really, really neat. But it seems to me that none of them really succeeds in explaining what we want explained here. And now I want to say a little bit about why. So probably the most influential metaphysical theory of laws of nature is what's called the universals theory. And it's been defended by David Armstrong, Fred Dretske, Michael Tooley, and maybe by Plato. Not entirely clear. Plato might have defended this view too. And the universals theory says this: a law of nature is a relation that two properties stand in, such that when one property, F, bears this relation to a second property, G, well, that it follows that the property F is connected to G in such a way that it brings G along with it, so that if an object has the property F, well, then that necessitates that same thing's also having the property G. And this is called the universals theory because the properties in question are supposed to be universals, which means they're supposed to be properties that exist as entities in their own right, over and above the particular things that have those properties. So why is it that laws are so counterfactually robust? Well, the universal theory's answer is that if the details of how the universe is laid out had been different in some way, well, then all that would really have been different would be matters of which things have which properties. The properties themselves would still have been the same. So the universals themselves would still have been the same. Which universals exist and which ones are related by this necessitation relation to which others, that would all still have been the same. So the laws would still have been the same. The laws would still have been the same because they follow from these facts about universals. And the facts about universals are counterfactually robust. But look, all that does is push the problem back a little bit, because now we want to know why are these facts, the ones about the universals, why are they counterfactually robust? And you might say, well, they just are. Obviously, the facts about which universals exist wouldn't have been different if particular conditions had been different. Those just are counterfactually robust, and that's sort of where the counterfactual buck stops. And you could say that, but if you're going to say that, it's not clear why you shouldn't have said it a little bit earlier and said, well, look, the laws of nature are counterfactually robust. Obviously, they are, and that's where the counterfactual buck stops. What have you gained by going back one step and introducing universals and these relations among them? It seems to me that you haven't gained very much, at least you haven't gained much in the way of explaining why the laws are so counterfactually robust. So that's why it seems to me that the universals theory doesn't really explain what we wanted explained, whatever its other virtues might be. But now it doesn't really explain what we want to explain. Instead, it just pushes the problem back. It passes the counterfactual buck, so to speak. But you might think that, well, how are we going to do any better than that? How could you explain why one set of facts are counterfactually robust without supposing that some other set of facts are counterfactually robust and that the laws inherit their counterfactual robustness from this other thing, and then you're stuck with the problem of why that thing is counterfactually robust? It looks like this is a problem you're going to run into sooner or later anyway. Is there any way to escape this problem? It might be an inescapable problem, but I don't think it is. I think it is possible to make real explanatory headway here. And what we have to do to make explanatory headway would be something like this: to come up with a plausible account of what counterfactuals really are. That is, what counterfactual discourse, counterfactual reasoning really is. What it is we're doing when we engage in discourse and reasoning about hypothetical non-actual scenarios, and come up with an account of what laws of nature are, and then show that the two accounts kind of mesh in the right way, so that it seems that laws and counterfactuals were made for each other, so that given what laws are and given what counterfactual reasoning is, it just follows that the laws should be held constant when you're doing counterfactual reasoning. If we could do that, then it seems that we could explain why laws are so counterfactually robust without just passing the buck in the way I was just criticizing. So, Well, I'd rather not, but if the spirit is moving you with particular force, then...
Well, it's just you're skipping over something that will bother a lot of people.
Okay, okay.
Which is that you're talking about the laws being counterfactually robust, but we can imagine making a column of counterfactually robust Lagrangians and another column of non-counterfactually robust Lagrangians. And it's simply a mathematical problem as to what goes in which. And I assume that, in the first column, you don't uniquely pick out the laws of physics we know and love. There'd be an awful lot of others which are also
that's an open question to you, actually,
right.
Do that intersection.
Yeah.
It's a mathematical question.
So I figured you weren't going to address that. That's why I'm raising it now.
Right,
so
okay.
I don't want to hold you up, but just to note that this obviously needs...
Okay, good. Well, let me say a little bit about it now that may or may not be satisfactory, and if it's not, then you can... bring it up again. I've been talking kind of fast and loose about counterfactual robustness. Obviously, counterfactual robustness is not an all or nothing affair. For one thing, there are degrees. Some things can be counterfactually robust across a wider range of counterfactual scenarios than another thing can. And it seems to me that in the case you're talking about, you've got that kind of hierarchy. So you've got, if it's, suppose it's to keep things easy for a non-physicist, suppose we're talking about classical mechanics. So you've got the fundamental dynamical laws, and then you've got all these different Lagrangians that you could plug in. So then we're assuming that the fundamental dynamical law, that would still have been the fundamental dynamical law, even if the particular Lagrangians that various systems had been different. So that's sort of the most counterfactually robust thing.
Well,
okay, but you agreed to keep it classical.
Classically, there are things like gauge. Things like that. You can ask the cardinality. And you could also ask the very real question of once you do identify the set of Lagrangians, all of which will be counterfactually robust, however that's specified. Is there any meaning to saying, well, one of those are the laws of nature and one that is not?
Okay, maybe not. Maybe you've got you might have something like a hierarchy. Different things are, some things are more counterfactually robust than others. Some things might both be counterfactually robust across different
ranges.
And
that's a mathematical question.
Yeah.
What I don't really see. I don't see why it's purely a mathematical question. So if you want to say, in order to ask the question, would this still have been the Lagrangian given these other conditions, there's something you've got to hold constant. I mean, you can't just... from nothing but pure logic.
You can say, take whatever we think is a Lagrangian, and then ask how many other Lagrangians would phenomenologically be indistinguishable.
Right. Because you can always add higher order terms with smaller coefficients.
Just to clarify, if I could, I know you did more questions than I can see why. And I know Lee's digesting me. But just to distinguish, you could say that the law of physics is something like special relativity and Lorentz invariance is robust against, but then it's not, right? Because then you come up with general relativity and you say that there's general diffeomorphism invariance, but you don't require a specific symmetry to be true about the world, like Lorentz invariance. Which one of those would be considered counterfactually?
Oh, okay. So when I say the laws are counterfactually robust, I'm assuming that it's not just whatever we at a certain time think are the laws that are counterfactually robust. If it turns out that special relativity isn't right because there's general relativity, well then special relativity wasn't really the law. It was something like a special case of the real law. But so then it turns out that that's not really...
I guess I'm just saying that there seems to be a competition, and maybe I'd be happy to leave this until the end.
Okay.
But just there seems to be an interesting competition of pursuing the fundamental law of physics between finding that special symmetry that you believe to be the law, and then arguing that that makes it not counterfactual robust because it is a special symmetry, such as, SU3 plus SU2 plus U1 or something like that, where you are saying that symmetry is the law of physics, but then you're saying, well, then it's not counterfactually robust if I'm understanding your language, because if there were a different symmetry, gauge group, then that would not be the law of physics that describes...
Are you trying to rescue me?
Maybe.
Okay.
So I think just to say, I'm going to later try to draw the distinction in terms of initial conditions.
Okay.
David just said, and I think that that's an obvious case, you know, the distinction between the law's initial conditions, and I hope we'll talk about when it holds and when it breaks down. But what about, for example, the mass of the electron? I mean, the universe would be much bigger, different, and would evolve much differently if the mass of the electron was slightly different. So that seems like an aspect of what you'd like to call a law of nature, which is not robust.
Okay. So thanks for bringing up initial conditions. So the kind of counterfactual robustness I'm really thinking about here is robustness, clearly the laws of nature wouldn't still have been the same even under condition, under all possible conditions, because if the laws of nature had been different, the laws wouldn't have been the same. If Aristotle had been right about everything, the laws of nature wouldn't have been the same, and so forth. It's the kind of counterfactual robustness that the laws have is across variations in, well, the initial conditions and other things that we think are physically contingent because they're consequences of the initial conditions. So now I don't want to presume to have an opinion about whether it's a law that the electron has a particular mass that it does. Suppose that that is a fundamental law. Then if electrons had had a different mass, then of course that wouldn't still have been a law. But if we, because nothing can still have been, be such that it would still have been true even under some supposition that's inconsistent with it. But if, the total amount of mass energy in the universe had been different or something like that, assuming that it's a law that the electron has a certain mass, then it seems that it would still have had that mass. If it's not a law, if the fact that the electron has the mass it does is a consequence of some deeper laws together with contingent facts about the history of the early universe or something like that, well then, that's only going to be counterfactually robust to a certain extent. So to make it a lot more, to go to a much more basic kind of physics, think about, so Galileo's law of free fall. To a certain extent, that's very counterfactually invariant. If I picked up my glass and dropped it, it would fall according to Galileo's law of free fall. If I'd worn a different color shirt, Galileo's law of free fall would still have held and so forth. But if the Earth had had a different mass or a different radius, then Galileo's law of free fall wouldn't still have held because we now know that that's not really a fundamental law. That's a local consequence of a more basic law together with the contingent conditions around here. So you've got all these different things that have different ranges of counterfactual invariance. And what I'm supposing here is that whatever the fundamental laws are, they're the ones that have the broadest range of counterfactual invariance.
And so it's normative, not just descriptive.
If you mean it normatively, are you allowed to say any proposed law that has something that looks fragile, that is, the universe would have been different, were it different, for example, the masses of the elementary particles,
okay,
is a candidate for being overthrown and replaced by a story where that is actually swept into the realm of initial conditions?
I think that's a hard question to answer because it seems that however we would go about figuring out that that thing is fragile, it seems that would be the same way we would go about figuring out that that's not really a fundamental law. The claim I want to make is that those go hand in hand. Discovering that the thing is fragile is the same as discovering it's not really one of the fundamental laws. But
we can easily make arguments about each of the things that are claimed to be laws now that are fragile. For example, the mass of the electron. The history of the universe would be extremely different for the mass of the electron, even
sure,
slightly different.
Sure.
So are you willing to stand on your definition and use it normatively and therefore make a case that the standard model is not really a law?
I don't want to say that. That's your territory, not mine, right? What I want to say is this, that if the standard model would not still have held, if it's clear that, or insofar as it is clear that the standard model would not still have held up under some counterfactual conditions other than ones that are just flatly logically inconsistent with the standard model, then it's not a law. Okay, thanks. So let me see, where was I? I was talking about what it seems to me it would take to explain why the laws are counterfactually robust. And it seems to me that there's another philosophical approach to lawhood that's it's a much less metaphysical one than the one I was just talking about, that seems to me to hold out some chance of doing that. And this is what's called the best system theory. And it's mostly associated with David Lewis, but a bunch of other people have defended different versions of it as well. And the best system theory goes like this. There are a whole bunch of systems of regularities that hold in this universe. There's one really big system that includes every regularity in the world, and there are lots of smaller systems that include some but not all of the regularities that the universe conforms to. Some of these systems are more informative than others. Some of them are simpler than others. I mean, you can axiomatize them more simply. And usually these two virtues tend to compete with each other. If you're building a system, the more informative you want your system to be, other things being equal, the more axioms you need. And the more axioms you put into your system, other things being equal, the less simple it is. So for the most part, the more informative systems tend to be less simple, and the simpler systems tend to be less informative. But there might be one system that strikes a kind of optimal balance here. It gives you the best possible combination of informativeness and simplicity. If there is a system like that, let's call it the best system. So if there's a best system, it's something like the maximally economical summary of what goes on in this universe. So we can think of it as something like the best possible algorithmic compression of all the information about our universe. And now the best system theory says that what it is for a universe to be governed by laws of nature is nothing more or less than for it to have a best system. And the laws of nature just are the regularities that are in the best system. Now, how does this help with explaining why laws are counterfactually robust? Well, one view about what's going on in counterfactual reasoning is this. When we want to know what it would have been like had it been the case that X, you know, for any false proposition X, what we really want to know is this. What is it like in that possible universe where X is true, but is otherwise as most similar to the actual universe overall as possible? So what you want to know is, what are things like in the universe that you could get to by starting with the actual universe, modifying it to make X true, but leaving everything else on the whole as close to the actual universe as you can while maintaining logical consistency? I mean, you can't just make X true and leave everything else exactly the same, because that would introduce logical inconsistency. So you want to change it in the smoothest possible way, leaving the overall features as the general features as similar as possible.
If you don't have the laws of nature, well, if there isn't any arbitrary set of events.
Here I'm just talking about counterfactual conditionals. So suppose there were an elephant in this room. So consider the possible world where there is an elephant in this room that is otherwise as close as possible to the actual world. To generate that world, you can't just take this world, add an elephant in the room, and leave everything else exactly the same. You'd have to change other things as well. It would also have to be the case that sometime earlier there was an elephant near the building on its way here, and so on and so forth. If it just appeared here, then and everything else was exactly the same, then certain regularities that are true in the actual world, like that elephants don't suddenly appear out of nothing, would not have been true.
So those regularities are then playing
the... That's right. Yeah, the regularities... And that's exactly where I'm about to go. So if this is the right view of how counterfactuals work, then the features of the actual world that are most counterfactually robust are going to be the ones that are most important to take into account when you're making judgments of overall similarity between possible universes. And it's hard to see what would be a better criterion of overall similarity than sharing the same maximally economical summary. So if there are regularities in this world that are part of the maximally economical summary of this world, then a world in which there's an elephant in this room, but that summary's not right, would be less similar to the actual world than one where the maximal summary of this world is right. So the idea is that the laws, if the best system theory is right, then the laws are the regularities that are part of the best system. But matching the actual universe on its best system is an extremely important criterion of overall similarity among universes. And so for that reason, we should expect the laws of nature to be very counterfactually robust, because they're the things that a possible universe has to match our universe on in order to count as very similar to it overall. So that's how the explanation is supposed to go. And it seems to me does a little better than the buck-passing explanation I was talking about before. It doesn't just assert, here are some other facts that are counterfactually robust, and the laws of nature inherit their counterfactual robustness from that. It gives you a kind of at least somewhat plausible theory of what's going on when we reason about counterfactuals, and an at least somewhat plausible account of what laws are, and shows that they're kind of made for each other, so that given what the laws are and given what we're doing in counterfactual reasoning, you should expect that the laws are going to be held constant in counterfactual reasoning. That's the idea.
I mean, you're suggesting that laws defined in terms of this best system approach are going to be counterfactually robust.
Well, I don't actually mean to be suggesting that. I'm talking about that view. I actually don't hold that view, but I'm describing that view. But yeah, that is the idea, that laws, if laws are what the best system theory says they are, then matching the actual universe with respect to those regularities is going to go a long way towards making another possible universe similar to this one. And failing to match the actual universe with respect to those regularities is going to go a long way towards making it not similar to the actual universe. So if the things that are counterfactually robust are the things that are true in all the universes that are most similar to this one, then this explains why the laws are going to be counterfactually robust. Did that answer what you were?
So.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, you may disagree, but I think that's kind of nice. But nevertheless, I'm inclined to think that this isn't the way to go, that the best system theory isn't right. And the reason why has got to do with considerations about fine-tuned initial conditions. And to set the stage for what I want to say about that, I want to call attention to my personal favorite example of a fine-tuning argument, which is Newton's argument for the existence of God that occurs in Book 3 of the Principia. Now, I think that that's not often recognized as an instance of the fine-tuning genre, but I think it clearly is. And the argument goes like this. By this point in the Principia, Newton has demonstrated the working of the three laws of motion, the law of universal gravitation, and he's given a detailed description of the system of the world. And he notes that there are some features, well, the system of the world features certain really striking, beautiful regularities that don't follow from the laws. So, for example, all the planets go around the sun in orbits that lie pretty much in a common plane. They all go around in the same direction. And what's more, all the known satellites go around the planets they orbit in that same direction, too. And if you were building a universe from scratch to be governed by Newton's laws, and you were doing it by deciding how many bodies there would be, how big and massive to make them, where to put them, what initial velocities to give them, well, it's clear that the overwhelming majority of possible ways you might do that are not going to lead to any stable orbits at all. And among the ones that do lead to stable orbits, the overwhelming majority are not going to lead to anything like that nice system I just described, with everything going around in the same direction, more or less in a common plane. So the initial conditions of our world must have been very special. They evidently were not chosen randomly, but with exquisite care. So there must be a God, QED. We all know the subsequent history of this argument. Laplace found a way to get around it by introducing a hypothesis about the physical process whereby the solar system was formed. As a consequence of that hypothesis, that you should expect the system to have all the kinds of regularities that Newton pointed to, pretty much however the big nebula got started. So it turns out that fine-tuned initial conditions aren't necessary after all. And it seems to me that at least part of the history of inflationary cosmology is in a certain way a kind of recapitulation of that episode. In each case, you've got a story of the following form. There was a received theory, and it was noticed that if the received theory were the whole story, then the kind of universe we find ourselves in would require fine-tuned initial conditions. But that's silly. So we can infer that that received theory can't be the whole story. It needs to be either replaced or supplemented with an additional hypothesis about some new kind of physical process that would eliminate the need for the fine-tuning, like Laplace's nebular hypothesis or like the inflationary hypothesis. And now I want to propose to call any argument of either like Newton's argument or like Laplace's argument, a fine-tuning argument. So I want to use that term kind of broadly. So I'm going to count an argument as a fine-tuning argument if it starts out from the premise that if some received theory is correct and complete, then the kind of universe we find ourselves in requires fine-tuned initial conditions. And now you can go on from that premise in either of two ways. You can go Newton's way and say, so there must have been a fine-tuner, or you can go Laplace's way and say, so that theory can't be both correct and incomplete. It's either got to be incorrect or else it's got to be incomplete, so it needs to be supplemented with something else that eliminates the need for the fine-tuning. So this may be idiosyncratic, but the way I'm using the term fine-tuning argument, not every fine-tuning argument asserts that there really is fine-tuning. They just all start out from the hypothesis that if this theory is correct and it's the whole story, then there has to be fine-tuning in order to get what we see. The conditions in which it seems like a good idea to run a fine-tuning argument are cases where we notice that there is some striking general feature of the universe, like, for example, that all the planets go around in the same direction, or that space is mostly nearly flat throughout the observable universe, or that all the regions of space-time we can see are in the future light cones of regions where the entropy is extremely low, something like that, some kind of regularity that is very rich in consequences for the character of the universe, but which don't seem to follow from some set of regularities that we take to be the fundamental laws. But now it seems that the problem is that in any, the problem for the best system theory is that in any case like that, it seems that the system we take to be the laws couldn't be the best system. Take that system and then just add a regularity describing whatever this large scale lovely feature of the universe is that we know about. And it seems that system is going to be better, or at least it's not clear that it's not going to be better. Ex hypothesi, it's going to be a lot more informative about the character of the universe than the system we take to be the laws, and it's only going to be a little less simple, right? You get to it just by adding one more axiom. Now, if that's right, then it seems that the conclusion might be that if you assume the best system theory of laws is the right account of what laws are, then whenever you take yourself to have evidence that the kind of world we're in requires fine-tuned initial conditions, the right conclusion to draw is not that so the world does have fine-tuned initial conditions, the right conclusion to draw is so you've misidentified the laws. There's this other system that's better than that one. I should add, that's not to say that the system you get by throwing in that nice general feature would itself be the best system. Maybe it would be, maybe it wouldn't be. The point is just that the system you took to be the laws won't be the best system because there's at least one other system better than it. If that's right, it looks like that if the best system theory is right, then there couldn't be a universe with whose initial conditions were finely tuned to produce some nice large-scale structural feature. If whenever you think you're looking at a universe like that, look again, because you've misidentified what its laws are, so says the best system theory. And the upshot seems to be that any fine-tuning argument, either of the Newtonian variety or of the Laplacian variety, is no good at all. They're all based on a failure to understand what the nature of laws of nature is. So, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks. Newton's example was fine-tuning in the initial conditions, whereas you segued into fine-tuning in the laws. So it seems to me there's...
I didn't mean to say fine-tuning of the laws. I'm just talking about fine-tuned initial conditions.
But many of us are interested in fine-tuning in the law.
Sure. Right. Sure. But, right. So I overstated the case there. It's okay. If the best system theory is right, then any fine-tuned initial conditions argument. That's what I should have said. Thank you.
It's not, the classic example is inflation.
Right.
It's pre-inflation. People said this is an incredibly unusual initial state.
Right. Thanks.
Just
yeah.
Clarification.
Okay.
So if you say these things are failures, what do you mean by success?
Oh, what I mean by success is identifying that system of regularities, which is the best system.
Is there such a thing?
Well, if the best system theory is right, what I'm doing is criticizing the best system theory, right? So the best system theory says that there is such a thing, or else there aren't really any laws of nature. There's just regularities of various kinds. Because the best system theory proposes that what it is to be a law of nature is to be part of the best system. That it's motivated by the idea that the universe is governed by laws shouldn't be understood, you know, too literally. It's not that there really are some kind of forces imposing on the universe making it follow laws. It's just that say the world is law governed is just to say that it has a certain kind of structure or orderliness to it, which consists in its having a best system, a maximally economical compression of the information in it. So success would be finding the regularities that describe that structure. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And one common theme along a lot of what you've been talking about is, to me at least, it screams for maximization.
Okay.
So what you're talking about now, for example, in terms of best systems theory and nearness and things like this, there's all kinds of ways, thinking even in terms of something as simple as Turing machines and literally algebraic information complexity, that I could try to formalize what you're saying and try to somehow formalize what it means by fine-tuning its adequacy or inadequacy,
right.
And maybe even in that demonstration, if you were to get careful enough in your definition of the kinds of systems that you're trying to use Turing machines to describe, you could even tease out something about the distinction between initial conditions versus laws, being things like the initial state of the tape versus the actual algorithm of the tape or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Has anybody tried to do that? Obviously,
yeah,
you're making
right.
precise
there's good, thanks for asking that. There's a guy named Ned Hall, who in, I don't think he's published this yet, but he's been working on one way of revising the best system theory in a way that gets a lot more specific about what the standards are and and builds into the characterization of the best system a distinction between initial conditions and dynamical laws. Right, it doesn't, yeah, it okay, okay. Good, so the philosophers who defend the best system theory, which I don't, right?
Or any of the things we've heard about today, actually.
Or yeah, okay.
If they're reduced to math, then I would say we can discuss them more.
Well, let me go on then, because I'm going to get to one more, and we'll see if you like that. Lee?
Yeah. It seems to me the argument you just made about the best systems theory, I'm trying to help you here, because
okay.
If this is where you're going. It's part of a larger kind of paradox about also the robust about counterfactuals, this definition of law. Many of us dream that we will have a theory of the universe where everything is explained. Initial conditions,
even the initial
like
conditions.
Carl and Hawking talk about theories of initial conditions, etc. Okay. A theory in which everything were to be explained would be one in which every question was answered about the universe was answered in terms of some fundamental principle or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. In such a system of explanation, there would be no counterfactuals.
I think that's right.
Okay. So therefore, a maximally complete theory of the universe would not be a law.
Well.
Is it untestable too?
It. I don't think that last thing follows. If okay, when you say there would be no counterfactuals, I think
the description would be completely brittle.
There would be no non-trivial ones. Yeah. Right. So if things have been different in such and such a way, then what would have happened? Well, if there is the kind of explanation you're talking about, that's nonsense. They couldn't have been that way. And so then what are you going to say about a counterfactual conditional whose antecedent is impossible? Like, what if there were a round square drawn on that board? What would follow? Well, who knows? I mean, you might take any such counterfactual. In certain special contexts, you might be able to say something meaningful. Like, if I had drawn a round square on the blackboard, then you'd all be very impressed. Maybe that's a true counterfactual in some sense. But counterfactuals like this that have impossible to satisfy antecedents are well, we can characterize them as trivial ones. So what you would say, if there's a theory like that, then there wouldn't be any non-trivial counterfactuals. And so the laws of nature would still stand up under any non-trivial counterfactual. That would be true, would just be vacuously true.
Well,
so that's a kind of limiting case.
What I'm sort of looking for here is that there's some scale in which this kind of characterization of laws works, which is where some stuff is described and explained, but other stuff is left out.
Uh-huh.
That's why there's own kind of factual.
That's right.
The law that applies.
That's right. So the whole project here, yeah, assumes that there's a difference between laws and other stuff, that there's laws that constrain the way the world goes, but that they don't uniquely fix everything. If that turns out to be wrong, then it would ultimately be wrong to say there's a difference between the laws of nature and everything else. And so this is a project of trying to characterize what would be the difference between the laws of nature and other regularities that are true. If there really is no such difference, then you're right. This project
might be that this and other similar characterizations of laws of nature apply to subsystems of the universe.
Okay.
Just not the ambition to scale them up to quote a complete law.
Okay, that could be.
Is mistaken.
That could be. So you could one way of modifying the best system theory would be to instead talk about local best systems. So define a certain domain of phenomena, the best system within it. That's the laws of that domain. And a lot of people have proposed that we can characterize laws of different scientific fields this way. So informativeness is, well, to a certain extent, the eye of the beholder. What biologists find informative, physicists and cosmologists might not find informative. So the biologists might have their own best system, the best system for biological purposes, which is the biological laws. The physicists might have their best system, which is the physical laws. That's another variant. And that's similar to yours. You might, instead of dividing it up by scientific field, you might just divide it up by energy domain or region of space-time or scale. Yeah, okay. Thanks. Kevin?
I wanted to get to the end of your talk because there's a lot to talk about here.
Thanks. So I'll push ahead. Where was I? So it looks like you can't have fine-tuned initial conditions in the universe if the best system theory is right. And yeah, you might say, okay, so look how useful and fruitful the best system theory turns out to be. You accept it, and you get to throw away all these fine-tuning arguments. You eliminate a whole pile of rubbish all at once. But the flip side of that, of course, is that insofar as we think not all fine-tuned initial conditions are rubbish, even if maybe some of them are not, that gives us a reason to reject the best system theory, because it can't make sense of the idea of a universe with fine-tuned initial conditions. And that gives us a reason to look for a different kind of theory of laws that that does better. And so what might a theory like that be like? Well, here's the thought. First, notice that any regularity that the universe conforms to corresponds to a method for finding out something, for finding out the value of some variable. So for example, suppose it just so happens that throughout the universe, the mass of any planet, M, is related to its mean orbital velocity, V, by a certain function, F, so that M equals F of V. That could be true. If it so happens that no two planets anywhere have precisely the same mean orbital velocity, then it's got to be true. Maybe not for some function F, maybe not for a very pretty function F, but for some function F, that would be true. Of course, it's not very likely, it seems, that that's going to be one of the laws. That's more likely going to be just one of these other mathematical regularities that the universe happens to conform to because of the way it happens to go. But that regularity corresponds to a way of finding out the mass of a planet that goes like this. You observe the planet and measure its mean orbital velocity, plug that into the function f, do the calculation. Now, of course, to do that, you'd have to know which function f is. That might be a trick, But here I'm not interested in the question of whether we could actually carry out this method. I just want to focus on the method itself. That's a method for finding out masses of planets. And in a certain sense, it's a perfectly reliable method in the sense that whenever anybody actually carries it out successfully, correctly, they're going to get the right answer, x hypothesized, because that relation F does hold between the masses and mean orbital velocities. So there's a sense in which it's reliable. We might say it's de facto reliable. But there's obviously another important sense in which it's not very reliable at all. It is de facto reliable, but its de facto reliability is an extremely fragile accident, right? It depends very sensitively on the particular details of how the universe is laid out. If conditions had been just a little bit different so that the distribution of masses and orbital velocities among planets had been a little bit different, there's no reason to think that this would still have held. Maybe some other regularity of the same form with a different function f plugged in would still have held. But the one I'm talking about with this particular function f, then, no reason to think that would still have held. So the method I'm talking about for finding out masses is de facto reliable, but its de facto reliability is not counterfactually robust. It's extremely counterfactually fragile. Now, by contrast, the methods that astronomers really do use to find out the masses of planets aren't like that. They're counterfactually robust. Their reliability is not so sensitive because they're designed to exploit the laws of nature. The regularities that back them up, that guarantee their de facto reliability, are laws. By contrast, the regularity that backs up the silly method I was just talking about, that's not a law. Similarly, or I should say, moreover, it seems right to say that the methods astronomers really do use count as legitimate measurement methods. I'll call on you first, okay? I promise. Or whoever's calling on, I'll ask them to call on you first. The methods astronomers really do use are, we might call them legitimate measurement methods. They can legitimately play the basic evidential role in science that measurements are supposed to play. By contrast, the silly method of finding out masses I was just talking about, not so much, right? It might be that whenever anybody actually carries out that, maybe nobody does, it might be that if anybody ever does carry out that method, they get the right answer. But that's just kind of a big fluke, because it's just a big fluke that masses and orbital velocities are related in that way. So that method, even if it's in fact, de facto reliable, doesn't seem like it should count as a legitimate measurement method. Doesn't seem like a legit way of measuring the mass of a planet. It's just too fluky. Now, you might... Okay, so I think that point generalizes. I think that in general, we're willing to say that a regularity the universe conforms to is a law, if and only if we're also willing to say that a method for finding out the value of a variable whose reliability is guaranteed by that regularity is a legitimate measurement method. And someone might agree with the general claim and say, but the reason why that's true is just that it's a trivial consequence of the definition of a legitimate measurement method. We can define a legitimate measurement method like this. A legitimate measurement method just is a method for finding something out whose reliability is underwritten by the laws of nature. Maybe. But what I want to suggest is that maybe it actually goes the other way around. Maybe we should analyze the notion of a law of nature in terms of the notion of a legitimate measurement method and say that what it is for regularity to be a law of nature is just for it to be a regularity that the universe conforms to that is such that if you were to exploit it to design a method for finding something out, that method would count as a legitimate measurement method. So this is taking the idea of a legitimate measurement method as fundamental in analyzing the notion of a law in terms of it. And now I think that if you accept that view of laws, then you can give an explanation, a non-buck-passing explanation of why laws are so counterfactually robust. It goes like this. Here's another way of thinking about what counterfactual discourse is about, different from that similarity of universes way. And it goes like this, that counterfactual conditionals, at least some counterfactual conditionals, are devices we have for expressing views, judgments about what's fluky and what isn't. So, for example, if there's some guy who's been really successful, and I happen to think that his success is just a big fluke, I might express that by saying, if conditions hadn't been so favorable to that guy, he would have been much less successful. On the other hand, if there's some guy who's really successful, and I think the successes are due to his virtues rather than to luck, I might express that by saying, even if conditions had been very different, he would still have been successful. Now, methods for finding things out have virtues too, right? Some methods for finding things out are worthy of our trust, and if you rely on them, they can lead you to justified belief, maybe also to knowledge. There are other methods that aren't like that, and if you rely on one of them, then it might turn out that it always leads you to a true belief, but if so, that's just luck. Now, if I've got two methods for finding out masses of planets, and I think this one is de facto reliable and also worthy of our trust, then I might express that, well, and by contrast, the other one, maybe it is de facto reliable, but if so, just as a fluke, not because it's really worthy of our trust, not because that's a legitimate way of finding something out, then I might express that by saying this one would still have been de facto reliable even if conditions had been quite different, whereas that's not so for this one. So that's a kind of explanation for why laws are set apart from other regularities in terms of their counterfactual robustness. Now, so you can give that kind of explanation, which is not just a buck-passing explanation. That's a virtue it might share with the best system theory. Another virtue that theory shares with the best system theory is that neither one of them asks you to believe in the existence of anything that you don't already believe in the existence of. Right? The only substantive concepts that the theory I just described uses are the concept of a regularity that nature conforms to and a legitimate measurement method. And science, I think, can't get on without using both of those concepts anyway, so you don't have to buy any new ontology to accept this theory. By contrast, to accept the universals theory, you've got to believe in the existence of universals. You've got to believe in the existence of these connections among universals. It's not so clear whether it makes any empirical difference, whether those things exist or not, but you've got to believe in them in order to accept this theory of laws. So the best system theory and the theory I was just describing seem to do better by way of conforming to or obeying Occam's razor than the universals theory does, or than I think any other metaphysical theory of laws can do. But now what sets the theory I just described apart from the best systems theory is I think it does a much better job of accommodating the idea of fine-tuned initial conditions. Right? So it allows for the possibility of large-scale, lovely regularities in the universe that aren't laws just because they don't underwrite any legitimate measurement methods. Right? So take the Newton example again. So Newton points out that all the planets go around in the same direction, points out that that doesn't follow from what he takes to be the laws of nature. In fact, if anything, the laws make that shockingly improbable. And the best system theory has a hard time accommodating Newton's view there because it's hard to see why that fact isn't going to be part of the best system in the world that Newton thought he lived in, even if not obviously not part of the best system of the real world, but the, given Newton's views about the universe, it seems like that should have been part of the best system, so it seems like Newton should have taken that to be one of the laws, rather than this funny regularity that the laws actually make improbable. But the theory I just described seems to do a better job of accommodating Newton's view here, because that regularity, it seems, can't be used to design any measurement methods. You can exploit it to design a method of finding something out. You can use it to construct a method for finding out which direction a planet moves in around the sun. Here's how you do it. If this is the planet you're interested in, you find some other planet, you observe it and figure out which direction it's going around the sun in, and then you infer that this one's going in that same direction. And that's guaranteed to be de facto reliable because, in fact, the planets do all go around in the same way. But I take it nobody would be inclined to call that a legitimate way of measuring the direction of this planet's motion. That's just, it turns out to be a reliable way of finding it out, but it's not a legitimate measurement method. So since that regularity doesn't count, since that method doesn't count as a legitimate measurement method, the regularity that backs it up doesn't count as a law, according to this theory of laws. And so that shows that this account, unlike, I think, the best system theory, can make room for the idea that the cosmos has some striking large-scale lovely regularities that are not consequences of the laws, that are in fact require very special kinds of initial conditions given the laws. Insofar as we think it's possible that the universe really does have some features like that, that seems like a virtue of this theory over the best system theory. And that's the end. So how should we...
We'll take your question.
Okay. Thanks. I'm sorry, I should have been asking people's names before that I don't know. So I'm sorry, what's your name?
I'm Nia Yashisar.
Yes, okay.
I guess I'm one of the two astronomers in the room. So
okay.
I can object to what astronomers do have like that. But okay. I guess the main problem is that in astronomy, we don't have access to initial conditions, so they have only one set of initial conditions, which is the one that made arguments. So how do we know which law is, I guess, counterfactual and which law is not? Or which regularity is a law and which is not, because we only have one set of initial conditions.
Right, well, I think that's exactly why this is such a tough problem, right? With the, it seems that we do think that the laws are counterfactually robust in a way that other things aren't. I tried to suggest that the way things are done in statistical mechanics at least implicitly presupposes that that's true, but so it's sort of a mystery. How do we find out about that? We can only, I mean, it's not just a problem for astronomy, right? We can only observe the actual universe. The actual universe has one set of initial conditions. So how do we, you can't use a telescope to look at counterfactual worlds. So how do we find out about it? And that's, you know, I think it can seem really mysterious. And so that's, there's an advantage here for accounts of counterfactuals that you might call kind of deflationary. The idea that say that when we're engaged in counterfactual discourse, you shouldn't take us to be literally describing other possible worlds that are out there, that we're doing something else. And so the best system theory, the count of counterfactuals that goes along with it, is one way of trying to do that. It says, look, when we're engaged in counterfactual, when we're talking about counterfactuals, what we're really doing is just sort of imaginatively changing the actual universe and keeping everything as much the same as we think we can. And so, you know, we don't actually have to look at an alternative possible course of events through a telescope in order to do this. That's one way of going. The way I was suggesting was that when we're talking about counterfactuals, that's just sort of another mode of discourse in which we can talk about what we think about basically what's fluky and what's not fluky, what's the kind of thing you can count on. And so then the question of how do we know which counterfactuals are true comes down to how do we know which are the methods we can rely on and which are the methods we can't rely on that are at best fluky if they work or else.
What do you rely on? I mean,
if you, it's a normative claim. The idea is that if you do use this method to arrive at a judgment, then you're justified in arriving at that judgment. It's might turn out to be false. You can be justified in believing something that's false, and you might come up with a belief that's true even if it's not justified just by making a lucky guess or something. So it's a sort of an epistemological normative claim that I'm making about this.
So there is no way to test the reliability of the method.
Well, then that's, well, you can test whether it's de facto reliable, right? But it takes more than de facto reliability to be legitimate in this way. And you're right. That's not something you can straightforwardly experimentally test. But my hope is to eliminate the mystery about how we come to know that by just pointing out that, look, in order to do science at all, we've always already got to assume that some methods are legitimate for us to count on. And as we learn more, we can change our minds about which methods are the ones we can rely on. But there's no such thing as engaging in science without assuming that a certain range of methods are legitimate to count on. And so if counterfactuals are what I'm suggesting they are, then we're always committed to some of them anyway. And this is supposed to sort of take away the mystery of how we come to know any counterfactuals. It's not as if there's a counterfactual fact of the matter out there that we're trying to get it right about. It's that when we talk about counterfactuals, we're just expressing our judgments that we have to make anyway about which things it's legitimate to rely on and which things it's not legitimate to rely on. Hugh.
Just picking up on this thought, the interesting thing about counterfactuals is what we can rely on. It reminded me of a line I like from Alison Gottman, who said that counterfactuals are the price we pay for hypotheticals. And what she has in mind is that hypothetical reasoning about the future is something we need to do because we're incredibly ignorant all the time. We need to make decisions for our own welfare and other reasons about the future, and so we need to think about hypotheticals of the form. If it is the case that A in the future, what follows from that? And now, if you think that that is the basic form of inference that we're engaged in, and think of the counterfactuals as derivative from that, where we're thinking of something of the form, well, if it had been, it wasn't the case of A, but it had been the case of A. You get to something very much like your idea that what's important about counterfactuals is this predictability aspect. The reason I think that's, or one of the reasons why that's interesting in this context is, well, firstly, it ties counterfactuals down to something practical, something we can't get away from, the problem of coping with limited knowledge. But also, and this is something that Randy noticed in his sort of late view of the laws, which for him came after his early version of the best system theory. So in his kind of development, that also reminded me of the way in which your line of thinking is developed here. I mean, Ramsey said that the basic distinction between two kinds of generalizations was just the distinction between the ones which we believe in because we've looked at all the instances, so we believe all those of these because we've looked at all the A's. Now, they're not going to think generalizations of that kind aren't going to be of any use in dealing with new cases because, by definition, there aren't any new cases we looked at. So the interesting generalizations, the ones which do support predictions in new cases, are those for which our reasons for believing them are something else. And Ramsey suggested that those are basically the law-like ones. That's what it is to be law-like. It's to be projectable to new cases.
I think that the account I was describing has a lot in common with the Ramsey account. I probably
that was basically what I wanted to suggest. As an interesting connection to my model draw, and one which tied in very nicely with this point that you were making about the importance of counterfactuals being this predictability aspect.
Right. Thanks. Lee?
Why don't I go after?
Sorry.
Deserving that other people should get a chance.
Kevin?
On the best system view, I'm wondering if you aren't giving them too much because your objection to the universal view is that it just relocates the question of special intentionality of laws. In the best system view, there's this notion of economy, right? And then you mentioned that maybe compression, right? So data compression, or overall complexity with more general way of working that out, but in Kolmogorov's complexity theory, complexity is relative to choice of a universal Turing machine. Just a universal machine, right?
Okay.
I misspoke. The crucial point is that it doesn't have to be a universal Turing machine.
Okay.
It has to be a universal machine for some conventionally chosen computer language.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, once I see, if that's the way it's going to go, then it's sort of unmasked the sort of second level of Goodman problems, right? So,
right.
I mean, now there's not only this business about you need magical glue to glue the future to the past, but now you need some magical principle to choose one computer language over another.
Right.
Which just, to me, duplicates the problem rather than solving it, right? I mean, it's a double level of conventionality rather than a single level. And once I see that, you know, what I'm really appealing to is somebody in the basement of Microsoft drinking Jolt Cola, choosing conventions about what counts as one line of programming, and then I'm going to guide my views about counterfactuals on that. It just doesn't seem to be the right
you
kind
got
of
a
stuff,
better idea.
Right? It's the wrong kind of stuff. So I would just directly challenge that this is any explanatory account of the intentionality of laws at all.
Okay, well,
it's in the wrong direction. So I would say it's even worse than, at least universal is the right kind of phony stuff.
Okay. Not the wrong kind of phony stuff. Thanks. This actually is sort of, I think it's sort of connected to the last question I evaded from, sorry, remind me of your name.
David,
thanks. About mathematizing the notion of a best system. The guy, David Lewis, who actually is at least recently the biggest proponent of this way of thinking about laws, it never did try to say in any detail what makes one system better than another, in any kind of mathematical detail. And it's not because he was afraid of math. He did a lot of pretty technical mathematical stuff. But his view was that if there's a best system, then it's got to be best pretty much no matter how you measure goodness. I mean, given any, there might be a lot of different reasonable ways in which you might get measure the goodness of an information compression.
Kevin's point about the choice of machine kind of.
That's right. That's right. I think that's right. Yeah, it does kind of. Well, I think what Lewis would say that it's got to be the case that the best system turns out best no matter which of the machines you pick. And then
it's not going to work.
It doesn't work. It's working.
Right,
that touches on another point. Paul also raised some issues, and so did Lee, when Lee was talking about subsystems versus the whole system and counterfactuals relates to the whole system. And Paul was talking about things like alternative Lagrangians. Almost everything in your talk, I thought, was extremely rich in terms of providing things that cry out to be mathematized.
Okay.
Because otherwise we will be arguing about words and terms, and nobody will know what they're saying. But
right.
Even if, you know, if you were to lay things out, for example, in terms of chromogonal complexity, it would reveal, forget Kevin's precise term, it would reveal essentially the arbitrariness of the Turing machine, which you might not have perceived before, and then it would be an insight. If you were to lay out the Lagrangians, if following along with Lee, you were to say, well, we're concerned with subsystems rather than the whole system. To formalize any of these many, many things that you talked on, I think could be very, very fruitful rather than just leaving the level of words. Right?
Okay, good. And just throw in another place where I gave an argument with words that might cry out to be mathematized is when I gave the argument that the best system theory can't deal with fine-tuned initial conditions because you've got your system you think is the laws. Well, here's a way to get a better one. Just throw in this extra regularity. It's x hypothesized going to be much more informative, but not much less simple because all you do is throw in one more axiom. That's a really fast and loose argument, right? So, but in a way, here's the dialectical role of that argument. That's kind of, if there was a hardcore defender of the best system theory here, that would be kind of a challenge. So tell me why that's wrong. Tell me why it's not true that that system would be proven. To do that, you've got to do exactly what you're just saying.
Tell me why I should believe that in the first place, especially in light of the kinds of landmines that Kevin is talking about.
Right, right. So,
mathematize things.
Right, so here's the point. In order to deflect the objection I was raising, and in order to make it clear what the theory is really saying, you've got to mathematize, or at least in some way make more precise the idea of a best system. The people who actually have defended, the philosophers who have actually defended this theory, at least so far as I know, have never really tried to do that. Maybe if you did that, it would work out, and it would show that it gets around the kind of problem I was talking about.
Or it would reveal otherwise.
Or it would reveal otherwise. Maybe it would. So here's, in one way, this is the point of the talk, that you've got that kind of problem with the best system theory. But the way I was, you know, going through quickly, and so I sort of put it as if here's a refutation of the best system theory. But it's clearly not a refutation. There may be ways you could make the best system theory more precise that gets around this kind of objection. But the point is, that's work you've got to do in the best system theory. But here's an alternative way of thinking about what laws are, on which you don't have to worry about any of that at all, that seems to already give the right kind of answers, at least in cases like the Newton case, that doesn't require dealing with all those pitfalls that Kevin was talking about.
Once it's mathematized, we could make that determination.
What does what?
Once it's mathematized, we could make the determination of whether they are pitfalls.
Well,
Well, yeah, I mean, let's not get too much. I mean, this is a suggestion of an alternative to the best systems theory, which when it's fleshed out, may or may not have difficulties. But
right.
I mean, I think we only have 40 minutes to lay this out, so. But
so how are we doing for time?
I think Mark had a question.
It's actually relevant to this thing about map legislation, because I think you're suggesting going in the wrong direction. Notions like initial conditions and well-posed system already have fairly precise mathematical meanings, but I'm afraid that the philosophers have deviated from those meanings. And if you write down a well-posed set of equations, actually evolutionary equations seem to be assumed, they're almost always, particularly if you know the range of what you're looking at, include all sorts of ingredients that we would regard as determined by laws. I mean, the number of particles, let's take a classical, even a point mass system, a classical structure, number of particles.
Right.
And then some sort of average term for the contribution of the outside universe, that's not determined by law, and so forth. And then if you move to any sort of PDEs, then you do have serious questions about the choice of boundary conditions. And in, say, just a classical conditional mechanics sort of setup, your choice of you tend to hold more firmly to the what you regard as the boundary conditions acceptable for a certain sort of system.
So they're pretty counterfactually robust, too.
Those are, you don't believe they're actually even true. You think of them as shorthand for most, actually, there's so many factors here, but most, if in the generic case, neither your boundary conditions are, or even in many cases, your initial conditions are to be viewed as regions where the laws that you've written down in your set of equations actually fully apply. So a classic case, I mean, happens in relativity, but just take the heat equation. The normal initial condition you're going to find natural to apply, the heat equation won't apply there. This goes back to remarks of Hadamard about situations like that. Okay, so we're running together a whole bunch of, I mean, there's this identification of equations, right? I think we should go back just to the math and sort out really what's our notion of law
in an
intuitive sense, because there are many ingredients in there you don't want to regard as law. And actually the distinction between initial condition, even what an initial condition is, you usually can't answer what's a suitable initial condition until you know what the character of those equations are, what fits them properly, and the same thing with boundary conditions. Those are very delicate questions, usually. So I think that more attention should be paid to those well-established mathematical aspects and try to line up the philosopher's terminology a little bit more delicately.
Right, as opposed to just saying
laws
versus initial conditions or boundary conditions. It's not that simple.
We shouldn't use, those have firm meaning, and sometimes in this it's been changed to the number of particles. That's not an initial condition. That has to be, those things have to be set before you can settle on the initial conditions for that set of equations.
Okay.
So, but I mean, these intuitions about laws are all fine, but we should actually be careful of taking this well-established mathematical terminology and aligning it too loosely with the distinctions that we want to discuss. And there's always a danger, though, the last thing I'll say, is that there's a picture that sort of dominates physics that is that the universe is governed by ODEs of a point particle type, and we live in an island universe. But that's a very simple mathematical setting. We have very nice, even existence results for that kind of mathematics. But almost all mathematical physics is done in a more complicated setting, We can't assume it has the same character.
Okay, I think we should have one more question. We have to go to break.
Okay.
We'll have one talk today.
Right.
Very long discussion. So I don't know who's. Janine, I think, has.
I think you probably did.
Go ahead.
Actually, just a short comment about something that not just you're guilty of, but that most people are guilty of. Well, it's just a kind of methodological mistake, I think, maybe, to advert to sort of fundamental laws when you want to talk about laws, because to some extent, especially when you talk about counterfactual reasoning and modal reasoning in general, it divorces that talk from the kind of context in which they have the most direct, practical, and empirical meaning. I mean, this goes partly to what Hugh was saying as well. I mean, when we talk about counterfactuals, usually, I mean, the primary application is when we're talking about open subsystems of the universe. I mean, that's the first kind of instance in which they make their direct confrontation with, you know, empirical meaning. We talk about, well, what would happen if some
so
of the...
came in and hit it.
Right, exactly. Right. And then when we sort of widen the scope to talk about the universe as a whole, and this is partly why the problem with, you know, the cosmological laws gets going, is because to some extent that's an epistemically degenerate context.
Right. I didn't mean to be guilty of that. Was
okay.
I
think you deflected, you know, most of the talk about laws to talk only about fundamental laws, and it's.
I didn't mean to do that. There's many different kinds of laws, fundamental ones and other ones as well. Maybe this stuff about which particular Lagrangian you actually have might be a not so fundamental law, and they're all counterfactually robust to different degrees. And a way of spelling out the stuff about measurements is. Measurement methods aren't just counterfactually reliable or not, they're counterfactually reliable to different degrees. And so the different degrees there corresponds to the different kinds of laws that you have.
Well,
so
one of the things that it seemed like you were saying, which was we should reduce all counterfactual talk to ultimately deriving from the fundamental laws, where I
didn't
would say
mean,
you might
I didn't mean to
different.
Say that. I don't think that's true. Okay. Good.
So I can assume that. All right. Let's have coffee back here and let's start at 4:00. Okay.
Thanks.